I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to episode 7 of the Create More podcast. I have been fortunate enough this fortnight to sit down with Mr. Ken Shuttleworth. He was very, very kind enough to give me an hour of his time. I should probably say that Ken is my boss, but come on, who doesn't want to interview their own boss? To give you a bit of background, Ken Shuttleworth, he used to work at Foster's and did some incredible projects. He worked on HSBC Bank in Hong Kong. He worked on the Gherkin, Wembley Stadium, the Millennium Bridge. Had a fantastic career there. And then in 2003, decided to set up his own practice, Make Architects. And they've gone on to do some fantastic projects as well. We've done the Olympic Handball Arena, we've done the Cube in Birmingham, we've just finished Five Broadgate, which is UBS Bank's headquarters in central London. Who worked on that? Oh, yeah, no, that was me, yep. Bit of shameless self-plugging there. But a bit about Make. I mean, I think, generally, if you don't know much about Make, we're an employee-owned architecture practice, which is quite unique in the architectural world. It's a very similar set up to John Lewis. Employee owned basically means that we the people own the company, so we get a profit share. And yeah, it's really cool. It's we talk about it in the podcast and talk about all sorts of stuff. How Make started, you know, what why the name Make. It was really, really good fun. And I don't know many bosses who would just let one of their own staff just interview them. I should say a big thank you to Martha, Carly and Sharon, who were very helpful in setting all this up. And I thought there was a nice bit of coincidence that it was actually almost to the week where I'd been at Make for 5 years. So, who doesn't want to sit down with their boss? I basically get to interview Ken 5 years after he interviewed me. And I tell him an embarrassing story about the day I get interviewed. So all that and more. And listen to the end to hear who's on next podcast. Enjoy. It's the perfect size of a soundproof room. I guess it would be good to when we make it look slightly less like a sensory deprivation room. All right, if you rotate the microphone a bit, and then it should be able to come a bit closer. There you go. I think that's fine.
Good.
Yeah. Hang on. All right. Oh, I think I turned the microphone off.
Just your own kit.
Yep.
All right.
So, so I don't really have, it's kind of like a very free-form chat over, I guess, 45 minutes or an hour, how long time you've got. But the idea behind it is that I've done 5 so far now, and it's to kind of get to know the people behind practices. And it started off as, the way I describe it was like creative entrepreneurs, right? So people who, I guess, have had the passion to go out and do something on their own. I think that's what I've been really drawn to. And obviously, working at Make, I get to see the inner workings. And then I thought, well, if I can get the opportunity to sit down and chat with you, that'd be amazing. But I feel I should describe the podcast format, just because the ones I really like, I don't know if you listen to podcasts very often.
Occasionally,
but,
yeah. Not
the ones that are quite popular now seem to be like people are so used to sound bites and bits and pieces that I think people, I respond more to like an actual chat as opposed to like a series of bullet pointed questions. And I know the ones that are really popular are ones that are in that format. So I sat down with David Batchelor, and I think he thought I was going to do a writing interview. So when I pulled out all the audio equipment, I think he was a little bit surprised. But now I'm recording. I don't really have a huge introduction, but I am here with Ken Shuttleworth. Thank you very much.
Hello.
And I feel I should describe to people who aren't familiar where we are. We're in a very, very, very small soundproof room, which you very generously allowed me to kind of build. But I wanted to start the podcast with just talking about the new studio, to be honest, because I felt externally our 10th annual was like a real milestone and kind of makes history externally. But I thought internally, for me anyway, this studio has been a massive milestone. And I was wondering, have you noticed a kind of change, or is it exactly what you wanted? I mean, if you describe it a bit, I guess, to people who haven't been to the studio.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for the first 10 years, we've sort of been very generously looked after by Arup. So we've been sort of camping in Arup's buildings around Fitzrovia. And as an area, it's an area where I first came to London in 74. I started working in Fitzrovia. So when I set up Make, I wanted to move the office back into this area because it's such a great, great area to actually be in. The chance came up to actually look at our own space. And I think that's been the big change you're talking about. The fact is actually, you know, for the first time, a sort of Make-designed sort of building project. And, you know, just to describe, it's actually an underground car park, so it's it's below street level. And that's because rents in the area have just gone through the roof. And to actually stay in this area as a, you know, as a sort of architect, we needed to get the rent down. And by going underground, we obviously, you know, get a cheaper rent than being above ground, which is, you know, it's been a great benefit. So we can stay in Fitzrovia as long as we go underground.
Yeah.
And what's been great about this particular car park that we've converted is the fact it's light on all four sides. So we've actually got sort of, even though it's like light wells on the street side and on the back, so it's fine. We've got the light from where the ramp used to be coming down to the car park. We've actually got a courtyard that used to be part of the car park that had a sort of horrible plastic roof on it. We took that off and made it into a garden.
I think that's what surprises everyone when they come down. When I describe people, we're in an old car park, people are like, that sounds really dark. But it isn't at all. It doesn't, at no point has it ever felt dark. I think that's, I guess that's down to like Charlie's good hard work at doing all the lighting layouts. But I think people really love coming down here. I think because we've got one of the largest reception lobbies of anywhere in London, I think because we've got the whole ramp. I guess part of the thing I like was there's a kind of story of Make as you come down. You know, you've got all these models as you come down the ramp, and then we've also got you've been quite keen in getting the MakerBots, the little rapid prototype machines.
Robots, yeah,
is that something you want to see more of?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the coming down the ramp should become a sort of introduction to Make. You know, you can't see straight into the office from the street. You can see into the reception area. So we're going to do you doing that sort of wild sort of art installation. We look forward to that. But as you come down the ramp, the idea is to sort of show some of the work. So by the time you get to the bottom, you've actually understood what we're all about. So we actually are architects. We do design buildings, you know, and they're actually up on the wall. And I think the robots that make the models, you know, to have those whirring away in reception, I think is the best place to put them. So we're going to get 100 of them. I think there's about 6 at the moment.
Wicked.
We're going to have about 100 of them, and they're all going to be whirring away, making the models, because they're quite cheap to make, and it's a great, great thing.
I think, the thing I like is we're working with massive developers. So they're very used to understandably quite a corporate environment, and I think if we go back a bit, was it the 10th anniversary in this car park last year?
Yeah,
or was it the client party?
Yeah,
wasn't it?
The client party. Yeah.
And what was great is that we brought all the biggest developers that we work with, and we brought them into an empty car park. This is before we'd done anything, and we got food stalls, and it was
drove in trucks down the ramp and sort of set up stalls in the car park.
Graffiti artists had done some of the walls, and I remember seeing it going. I remember hearing the response to them, and everyone loved it.
Yeah, they say, whatever you do, don't change it too much. You know, just keep it as it is. We love it, because people just assumed it was some sort of party venue they hadn't been to before. You know, so it was a good event, actually. It was a great event, and it sort of kicked us all off. You know, into sort of the way we've actually tackled the space architecturally, is to sort of really leave it, leave the rawness of it. So we've just shot blasted the concrete slab. Just to get rid of the sort of flaking plaster. But we've left the columns as they were. So all the graffiti and all the sort of markings that's been on the columns for 50 years is still there. And then we've just, you know, just put some silver paper around the services that service the building above. Mm. And we've just put lighting where we can get lighting between the services. So it's been very, very simply done on a crystal concrete floor, which has got underfloor heating and cooling. Mm. And that's it.
Because I remember... one of the benefits, and I think one of the things which we kind of struggled with in, this is when we were in our old Arup office, so the one we were in before this one, for about a year or a year and a half, wasn't it? And when we first moved in, we had so many people, we could move them across two floors. Mm. And I always remember you said the kind of, we always want make on one floor.
Yeah.
And yeah, I remember working on Broadgate when UBS, like, no, we need these big floor plates, they're a requirement, we need all people. And I never really understood, why can't you just be on two floors? Why do you have to be on one? And I genuinely, the difference it makes having everyone on one big open floor, mm, it is amazing. And
I think everybody has to be together. I mean, the great thing is the scheme, the projects have always allowed us to sort of work open plans. So, you know, the fact we all work in, you know, one space, all have the same desk, all have the same chair, mm, it's always been important to me. There's no little sailor offices for people to go and hide away in. Now, basically, the whole office is, you know, is very democratic on that basis, and we can, and in fact, we're all together in one space with no walls. I think is, you know, enables cross fertilization of ideas from one project, yeah, to the next, allows people to feel part of a sort of social scene. You know, and the hubs become the coffee points. You know, the bins are sort of breakout areas. Yeah. The garden become a sort of little hub for everybody to get together. But I think going back to your original point, I think that the change of coming here, is like a dream come true for me. It's like after 10 or nearly 12 years now, finally got our own space, which has got our own identity. You know, it's quite lean and keen, which is what we're about. Mm. No frills, down to earth, sort of basic. Stuff with IKEA furniture and stuff we've made ourselves. You know, it's nothing too posh.
Because I think when clients come in, it kind of sets the scene for any meetings. That's why I think so successful is that they. I guess the hardest thing to describe to a client or a developer is the added value that make give to a project, right? And when they see just all the models, all the model making machines, everything kind of whirring away, and then they get deeper and deeper into this kind of, and then they come into our main office and they've got like 100, how many people in the office? 130?
There's 170 of us in total, so there's probably about 150 here, 140, 50 here.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I think, because I know quite a few people listening to this podcast the idea is that it's a creative podcast. As I sat with architects and designers and musicians as well, so it's kind of, it's nice to try and describe and kind of go back to the beginning a bit. So because I don't know, and I've not had the chance to talk to you about how kind of make very first started. So you left Foster's back in, so what, 15 to 2000?
So yeah, so I started architecture in 74 and I was at Foster's for until 2004, so I was there 30 years, and I got to 50 and I decided that, you know, it was like a now or never moment to sort of do something else, because I could easily have stayed at Foster's, great place, great, did some fantastic work there. And I could see, you know, Norma's going to live forever. So, you know, I could see myself staying there, for the rest of my career, which would have been great. But I think I got to 50 and I had a sort of moment in time. I just thought all the projects are either being built or, you know, in the hands of the contractor. And it was like a sort of now or never moment. You know, 19, when you get to 50, I think you do have, you'll probably find out you have a bit of a midlife crisis, you know. And I just thought, you know, it's like now or never to do something else. So, in fact, I never thought I'd do my own practice. I thought I'd go and work for somebody else. So I had interviews.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I had about 12 job offers for various architects. And I thought it might help with the Olympic bid or, you know, something like that at the time. And then when I had, you know, these job offers, and they were really generous job offers from various people, I thought, well, actually, I might as well give it a go, because, you know, if I have a go on my own, it doesn't work out, you know, at least three of them probably still offer me a job. So I might as well just give it a go.
Yeah.
So I thought, so we broke up for Christmas, and I had, you know, Christmas thinking about it over that 2-week period, and came back on the 2nd of January and just started. You know, sat in Arup's were great. They gave us a desk and a phone. And by lunchtime, James Thomas, who joined us, joined by lunchtime. There was about another person by the evening. You know, and the following day, somebody else joined him. And it just gradually sort of built over that time. And we, clients are very generous. You know, we had clients who came to us who then paid us up front for doing some work. So we never had to borrow any money, which was really good. And it set up in the first 6 months. I didn't take a salary out of the practice at all. And the first 3 months, nobody took a salary out. So they came for nothing. And then at the end of 3 months, I paid everybody who'd worked for that 3 months, their 3 months back pay. And I pay myself after, I think it was a year, my first 6 months wow. salary. So we know we didn't actually borrow any money. We Arabs were very generously let us use the office, using the photocopy machines. It actually worked. You know, it was really good for us. And I think it was, without Arup, it would have been much more difficult. So their computer systems were available to us, and we just plumbed straight into that.
And from the very first day, were you? Clear in your head? And...
Yeah, no. Before that, I'd had about a month of thinking about names. I went through a thesaurus and started sort of googling names and things. And I had all sorts of other names, like one was Blue Dot, I remember. one in fact was Populous, believe it or not.
Oh, really?
One was ADAS. These are names that now are familiar. To other architects, but they, at the time they weren't available. You go to Theosaurus, you find them. Anyway, I decided, I've always been a great believer. You've just got to get an expert involved. So you go to you don't go to the dentist. You don't pull your teeth out. You go to a dentist. Yeah. So I thought, and it's the same in graphics. That's why we have graphics people here. So I went to see a friend of mine, Brian Borden, who ran Wolf Owens at the time, and gave him the problem of coming up with a name. Because I just thought, I'm not going to get there on my own. And out of the sort of 4,000 names I'd looked at, Make wasn't on any of the lists at all. And it was their name. They came up with it. Wolf Owens did. Well, they tried to persuade me to use Shuttleworth, which I really didn't want to do because I just felt the whole philosophy of Make was about, in a way, the idea of employee ownership started at that point, the idea that it would be a practice that... there weren't any shares split out. All the shares are in a pot, and nobody actually owns any shares. Everybody's effectively working, as a partner in the business, because nobody actually owns it. We all own it in a way. So I didn't really want my name on the front door because, if I go under a bus, you lose your brand. Everybody would always phone me up and want me in every meeting. And also, I never really liked my name. It's not a great name, So they came after persuading me. I'd managed to persuade them not to use Shuttleworth. They did come up with Make in about 3 days, or 4 days. Yeah,
you're like, damn them.
And it's absolutely brilliant. And I just thought, the moment I heard it, I thought, what? And I thought,
yeah,
wow, that's fantastic.
Because you're saying it's about the Make ethos. I do think that every time you answer the phone and you say, "Where do you work, Make?" not "Where do you work, Shuttleworth?" So I think because you're not. There's no specific name. I guess you feel more as part of a team.
It's easy to give credit to people who do their job. It's easy to, succession's easier without, having a name on the, think of the businesses have got a name. And if, when the guy dies, they've got to come up with a, they just go to initials or something like that, like SOM, KPF. So I think that's always difficult. And if you set up a little, had a name on the door, maybe having two names on the door, then somebody else comes, three names on the door, So I just thought, I had no idea where it's going to go. So it was much easier to have an abstract name that has something to do with what we actually do. We make buildings, basically.
And also it must stand out as well. Like, there's so many kind of architecture practices. When you first started, it makes quite a bold name. I was trying to think of what other... Other names, I guess, a lot of them like Big or Fat, they're kind of the big one. They're still based on initials and stuff, aren't they? Yeah. So, I thought, Make must really stand out. And the press, did you have a good relationship with the press right from the off then? Because I think they were quite helpful in kind of...
The thing is, when I decided, I wanted to leave Foster's, I was, I never really thought I'd get another job. I thought, that actually... They knew who I was, and it's going to be quite difficult. What actually happened was exactly the opposite of that. People did know exactly who I was and what I'd been doing the last 30 years. Some of the press were really good, and they encouraged us to do more work and get more noticed. And in fact, the first 6 months, we got fantastic press without releasing any images at all. And then the first image we did release was the Vortex scheme we did for London, which then made the front page of The Guardian on the Saturday morning, which was quite a surprise, to be absolutely honest.
Did you find like a jump in when you got on the front page of The Guardian? You're like, all right, I'm getting somewhere now.
It's going to happen. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think right from the outset, everybody said it's going to be fantastic, except I was really wasn't quite that sure about it. Who knew? things happen in buildings. And you know, the way buildings come in, the way projects, you know, evolve is, you know, you're just never quite sure what's going to happen. So I was always a bit cautious about it, to be absolutely honest. So we, you know, we did, in terms of people who came to join us, we actually did match that to the income. So we, you know, we never went bonkers and employed loads of people, then tried to get some work. We actually waited, the money started to flow. And then as the money started to flow, you know, employ more people to actually do the work we had.
So when you kind of sat down first day, first kind of, I guess, team meeting, group meeting, you're like, oh, God, we're a practice now.
Well, no, I mean, it was all about getting the work. So we were on the phone. I was traipsing the streets. I had, you know, my little rucksack had just about everything that the office owned was in my rucksack. So, you know, the little booklet, and we started doing little brochures and things, using my house really as the sort of the only project that would you could legitimately say.
That was,
you
know, the Crescent House.
Yeah. Which had been built. It wasn't a Foster project, so it was, that was a good project to actually start, you know, touting around. But, you know, going around, seeing everybody, seeing developers, seeing planners, you know, Peter Rees, I remember seeing Stuart Lipton, seeing him, you know, lots and lots of people trying to sort of gauge, you know, how we could get some projects and start small, and, you know, we'd big up bigger ones as we went through.
Did you feel at the beginning that you were trying to, 'cause especially if the Crescent House was the first project you did, trying to, I guess people would come, they would know you from Foster's, so inevitably they would be like, well, can you do another building like that? And Mate was never about, it's never about repeating projects, it was about starting afresh and stuff. And I also thought the Crescent House was like a great first project to have, because it's kind of interesting. And did you feel that you were still, I guess, finding not a brand, but a way that Make approaches projects? That was kind of, that's your brand, isn't it? That's the kind of Make ethos, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've always seen design as an exploration. So I'm always, you know, looking at moving design on. And I think it's about, it's like a sort of pursuit, like a search for the next best idea. So, you know, I'm not interested in coming up with a house style that we just repeat, you know, in a way that sort of other architects do. I'm interested in just, you know, if we've done one in straw, let's look at one in, you know, in concrete, let's look at some in brick, let's, you know, let's look at materials, let's look at different ways of doing things. And I think the, you know, the absolute essence of Make is trying to do the best possible building on that particular site at this moment in time for that client. For his budget. And I think that's what we try and do. So every project is sort of eked out of the site, you know, and I think massive site analysis, for me, you know, gives you that sort of asymmetrical, so the Crescent House being asymmetrical, you know, some of the projects being very asymmetrical because of the site actually, you know, having railway lines on one side, you know, and maybe a park on the other side, you know, why are buildings symmetrical? I never quite get it. So I think that's sort of eking out the essence of the site gives you that unique quality, plus the client's beliefs, plus where we are now, you know, and what we know now in time about, you know, greenhouse gases, global warming, you know, what we know about the materials we can use, you know, we are building right this moment, you know, what we believe in. So the 5 Broadgate scheme that you worked on, that was all about, you know, this is a moment in time that, you know, where we got stainless steel sorted, you know, where we had a client who was really interested in low energy buildings so we could get rid of all the glass that we didn't need, you know, actually coming up with something that's very strong, and actually then turning the 5 Broadgate scheme, turning on its head the normal approach, which is sort of like a sort of, you have an office building, you add things to the outside and express them individually, to actually push all that together and squash it into a single form, I think is fantastic.
Because Broadgate's, we've just signed practical completion like two or three weeks ago. Is that felt like, because it seems crazy now. When I first started, it was, we'd done, I think it was 20 projects or maybe 15 to 20 projects, but it was, this was, everyone was like this. So out of the recession, or kind of, we were just kind of still in it, I guess, in 2010. But the idea that to have a project on site, that's why I leapt at the chance to work on Broadgate. I was like, oh, brilliant. But it was, everyone was not getting on site. I think that was a problem. And then, you know, fast forward to now.
Everything's on site.
Everything's on site, yeah. And
well, that's the case. The, you know, the market is cyclical. I mean, you know, 2007-08 was the bottom of the market. I think it hit us in 2009, more than 2008. Anyway, and it's slowly been going, rising up again over the last, well, it's nearly 8 years, isn't it? But, you know, I think it will go down again. No, no doubt it will go down again. So yeah. There's a sort of, you know, there's this way that the workload goes up and down, but, the, you know, trying to keep the number of employees the same is always very tough. But I think at the moment, we are in the moment where we're actually building stuff that's been around since post Lehman's, which we're now building out. And we've got about 17 buildings on site, I think. Mm. I think we've built 50 now in the last 12 years. So yeah, it's quite a portfolio of stuff.
I also remember working on Broadgate. That was seen. It was such a big building for us to have in comparison to the projects that we'd kind of completed up until then. And now you look at Broadgate, it's just... It's we've been doing, I guess, 3 or 4 projects that are that's big or bigger.
Yeah.
And but, you know, we're just carrying on. It's Make has just kind of grown around. Everyone's become more experienced over the last 5 years. So it's been, well, for me anyway, to be here and kind of see it all kind of evolve around. I just said that I joined, I think I realized kind of nicely that 5 years ago, pretty much this week, this is when I joined Make. So actually, this is kind of like, I also, going back to kind of how Make set up as a practice, was if you ask anyone what they know about Make or anything, the first thing they'll say is it's supposed to be a really nice place to work, full of nice people.
Yeah.
And which to me seems really obvious, but I know a few friends who are like, yeah, their practices aren't like this, you know, because you can genuinely ask anyone any questions. Yeah. Like, I did just come up to you and just ask if I could do a podcast, and you said, yeah, and you just let me soundproof this room and sit down with you. And this idea of transparency in a company as well, you're like, yeah, but is it as transparent as you want? And it's like, well, if you want to ask anyone a question, ask anyone a question.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everything's on show. Everybody knows, you know, all the finances of the office is all out there for people to see. The only thing I've never released are the salaries. I never quite understood the benefits of doing that. But if somebody can convince me that's a good idea, we could do it. But I haven't found anybody who's ever said it's a good idea. So all the others, but everything else, everyone knows what's, you know, profitability, because we share the profit. You know, there's no, you know, it's not like, you know, I'm going away buying yachts and aeroplanes. You know, I'm not doing that. I have the same, I have a salary like everybody else. I get the bonus the same percentage as everybody else. Well, profit share is not really a bonus, it's a profit share. You know, I still have a big mortgage. I mean, that's, you know, people ask me what's the downside of the, you know, the employee ownership model. I think, you know, I mean, working with fantastic people, doing great projects, you know, everybody feels happy, everybody sort of mucks in. It's, you know, it's a really good model. And the only downside is the fact I'm not a multimillionaire. Yeah. And I, you know, but what would I do with the money anyway? So I'm, you know, I'm really, really happy that, you know, I'm not taking that stance. And I'm really happy the way that we've done it. It works really well. And I, you know, one day I'll pay my mortgage off and it'll be fine.
One day. Because I remember when you, because I got the interview, like, oh, you can come work for Make. And it was a really hot summer and I came in. And this is kind of, it's a funny story because it just kind of, it set the scene on how approachable I did find you, that you were. I'd built this massive Perspex portfolio and we went down in the meeting room of our old office and I'd stuck my name on the front and it's huge. It was so cumbersome and you were flicking through all the work and it got to the end of the interview and you're like, oh, thanks. And I was like, oh, I hope that went well. And we were putting all my work back in and I couldn't quite get it to fit. And as I dragged my portfolio around the table, one of the letters pinged off onto the floor of my portfolio and it fell under the table. And I was like, oh no, embarrassing. And then you're like, it's fine, I'll go and get it. So like you were under the table, I was trying to find the other letter under the table and I was like, oh, I'm crawling around under the table at Ken Shuttleworth. And then, but I just remember thinking, oh, I've blown it. And then got the phone call. But it was nice just to think that, yeah, just it's a friendly company. And I remember just going out and sitting down with Jamie and just thinking, But it did set the scene. I just thought, yeah, it's going to be great. And then I was thinking the next, what I did want to talk about as well, so we talked about the practice, was one thing I think Make are really good at as well is social media side of things. And I've been, all the other people I've chatted to about podcasts and things, I guess I want to, like, what do you think of social media? Because you're very active on it.
Twitter, yeah, I love it. Yeah. I mean, I'm, you know, almost addicted to it. I wouldn't say totally addicted to it, but, you know, I do follow Twitter. I haven't done Facebook. I did register, but I've never actually used it.
Mm.
Maybe it's just too many things with emails and Twitter's probably enough without carrying on. I actually got to do some work during the day as well. But no, I think it's great. And I think, you know, we have Kylie, who is a full-time tweeterer. whatever the expression is, tweeter.
Yes.
You know, and that's, you know, people here tweet. And I think the only, you know, the only thing is just to be careful, I think, with social media. You know, you can see people get caught saying the wrong thing. You just got to be really careful what you say, and that's 147 characters. So I think it's, I like it, you know, but you know, I wouldn't do it when I wasn't concentrating.
Yeah,
I wouldn't.
You can get yourself in a lot of trouble with 147 characters.
Absolutely. So I think it's, you know, you've got to use it sensibly. And I try and use it for architecture. So, you know, there might be the odd personal stuff, which is always interesting. But I think the, you know, if I'm going to see a building, you know, just been to, Italy and sent back some, you know, images of San Gimignano, you know, that sort of stuff. If I, you know, I just think that side, or been to Mumbai, you know, just took some photographs of that, sent those back. I think it's, you know, just sort of showing for architects, you know, something that's interesting. I got about 6,000 followers, so so it's pretty. Some people are interested, what I have to say.
So do you think it is helpful after an architecture practice? I mean, we wouldn't because we've got a massive kind of Twitter following, like 10,000 or 11,000 people, and it's. So you do think it's an advantage?
Yeah, I was in Istanbul and I sent a tweet saying it's great to be back in Istanbul. You know, fantastic place. You know, great. I got a tweet from somebody saying, "I'm a journalist here in Istanbul. Can I come and see you?" You know, I run an architectural magazine. So I said, "Great." When we met, you know, and it was all over the wire, so everybody could see what was going on. So, you know, we met for breakfast and we had an interview, she took a photograph and we had a magazine article about us being in Istanbul, you know, within about 3 months. And the same happened in Delhi. I had the same thing happen in Delhi. So a journalist found out I was in Delhi on Twitter, came to see me, and we, you know, she then published a complete article about make and photographs and everything. So I think that's been good. And I think, you know, it's interesting if I'm interviewing somebody for a job here, I will see if they've got a Twitter account, see what they're saying.
Oh, really?
You know, if the client, we get a new client, we see if they've got Twitter accounts. And, you know, some of our clients do, some of the clients don't. But I think it's, you know, it's interesting to sort of, you get a different perspective on personality by
I guess Twitter. You kind of touched on a point there as well, that you're in India.
Yeah.
And you're around the world, because when Make started, we were obviously just, you know, you were very small in London. It's grown very quickly. But now we've got office, we've had offices in Dubai, had offices in, and then you had one in Scotland and Birmingham, but then branched out even further to Hong Kong. We've got work in Sydney now.
Yeah.
We've basically got an office in Sydney, like a small satellite office and things. Yeah. So,
and Beijing.
Beijing, yeah, of course. Mm. Yeah. And so Twitter, again, there you go, is a perfect example. But having such a... You know, we were saying about the recession and kind of how you're trying to control that flow of work.
Yeah, yeah.
Having a kind of, well, I guess, a worldwide base of potential architecture must help hugely.
Yeah, I mean, I think in 2008, when Lehman's went down, you know, I had stopped recruitment in 2007. So actually, since Northern Rock went down, I stopped recruitment. Other architects were still going bonkers and recruiting, and we stopped. And we had a struggle because we got work to do that we couldn't really. You know, we were struggling with the number of people we actually had. But the interesting thing was we also had a base in Beijing at that point. And then what actually happened was to chase work when it was going to, I could see the recession was going to come. But we went all over the world looking for work. So we went to South America, we went to all over the Middle East and in the Far East. And in fact, the Far East is where it actually did work. And we did get work in China and Hong Kong. And that, in a way, was supporting the office through 2009 when they were sending work back for us to do here rather than the other way around.
Really? What? Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, and that was, and it worked really well. They had, you know, four or five major jobs and we were doing them here. And I think that's the most incredible thing is that, you know, we have an affinity to the Far East, I think, as a practice. Mm. You know, I think I worked in Hong Kong many years on the bank and again on the airport, and lots of guys here from Hong Kong. So, you know, we have an affinity to go and we can easily, you know, move to the Far East tomorrow, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas the Middle East proved more challenging and we didn't really get any work in the Middle East. And I think, you know, South America, America is much more difficult for us to get into. But I think, you know, we will just, we can go anywhere, you know, we've got a global reach. And I think, you know, as far as I'm concerned, there's no places off the map that we wouldn't want to go to.
When you did the email saying we need some more people in Sydney, it was like whose hand went up the fastest. It was like, yeah, I'll go. Yeah, okay, that'd be amazing. I think, but I remember, you know, we've got quite a lot of work in India as well.
Yeah.
And you kind of get the feeling that with the team that we've got here, and I guess the whole infrastructure that we have means that, as you just said, you know, work can come back here or work can go around there. You can kind of get almost 24-hour working, I guess, to
yeah,
a point.
You can,
just
yeah.
Constantly kind of churning away, because, you know, you're saying you're struggling at the beginning to get work in certain places, but you said Hong Kong, because I heard you say in another talk that you love Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Hong Kong was brilliant. Yeah, so yeah, I guess trying to get work there was, I think we should go back to Hong Kong again. I think we should just keep going to Hong Kong. But how long were you in Hong Kong for?
I worked on a Hong Kong bank in back in late 30 years ago, actually. So I was there for about, on the project, about 7 or 8 years, of which I went to Hong Kong probably every month for a couple of years. And then I lived there for about nearly 4 years while the bank was being built. And then we had a 10-year gap, and then we went back on the airport. And I commuted back and forth to Hong Kong for about 2-3 years, probably every month, every 2 months.
Wow.
So, I know it really well. And, it's one of those, it's one of the most exciting places in the world to go, you know, compared to other cities. It's, you know, a really vibrant place.
Could you describe, I think it was a talk on tall buildings, and you were saying like New York has this wonderful green space in the middle in Manhattan, Central Park, and that's this kind of, that's the release, and you went Hong Kong just literally running on pure energy. Because I went there, I think I went there 4 or 5 years ago, and me and my wife had been traveling around, and then when we got to Hong Kong, it was like being in a movie set. Everything was so clean, everything was seemed just so new, and so it was just massive. And that was, you know, no one knows how big it's going to get, but I just think it must be so exciting for you, because I guess once you've got to a point where at Foster's you worked on so many massive projects all around the world, then you started Make, and Make have been doing really well. Like, kind of what kind of, I guess not drives you, but what keeps you kind of interested? Is it like?
Oh, no, I mean, I'm just very curious. I mean, I've got a great curiosity for exploration, and almost like an adventurer trying to work. So, I've got, there's no way of retirement. There's no sort of, that's not even an option. Because I just cannot stop, thinking about the next building, thinking about how we can save the planet, thinking about how, what there's still so much to do. We've got to design buildings which are much more energy efficient, which, we're striving towards, but we've got to get there. We've got to keep going until we get there, until we get to zero carbon or positive carbon. I think that's, really drives me on. I think there's so much more to do. The idea of stopping is completely out of question. But, for me, I think it's... it's about, it doesn't have to be bigger projects. I think just, better projects, or, being able to do things in a different way, I'm really interested in. So we still do smaller projects and shops and things, which are great. Still do interiors projects and, small scale houses. Just as satisfying as a larger job.
Because it's, I guess as well, the nice thing about having all of us on the same floor is that what I like now is that there's so many projects going on. And obviously for you, this is way better that you can... I can walk around and there's meetings going on. You can look into rooms. There's all sorts of like models and stuff that why would you retire? It's like, why would you
I
want
do?
To?
Yeah. What the hell would I do?
Just keep going home and then what?
But also I've got a 5-year-old son, so I can't retire. Anyway, I've got to get him through university yet, so I've got at least 15 years
especially
ahead of
me. If he's going to be an architecture student, there's an unlimited amount of resources required. So I was going to also ask you, because you... I heard you talking about BIM, and you're saying it's just a design tool.
Yeah.
And so for those, like, building information modeling is kind of the next thing that we're trying to move into, isn't it? And a lot of our buildings, I think as an industry, we're still trying to find our footing for kind of how, especially for architects, I know how we implement BIM, how it's best to be used. But I think sketching and stuff, you've been in the industry now, you've seen the kind of the CAD get introduced and the whole 3D and then everything, but there's no kind of, has it changed a huge amount? Because I know when we're doing the project that we're working on at the moment, we're still referencing buildings from 50 years ago, 70 years ago, all the same things are there. So do you think BIM's, from architecture point of view, changed the industry a huge amount?
I remember the big change from drawing boards to computers, and it was like changing from sort of coal to electricity on the railways. It must have been a massive change, and a lot of us who'd been brought up on drawing boards just didn't want to make a change. A lot of architects fought it to be absolutely honest, at the time. But because now, you know, just it's just a no-brainer. You know, everybody's got a computer and we all draw, everything gets drawn, sketched in. It's still a sketch, but, you know, they still get drawn up on the computer. And I think what it did was actually as a sort of freedom for a while when people understood how computers could operate. They could, you could start designing buildings with sort of double curves, mm-hmm. you know, and sort of very complicated shapes. You know, we met a guy from Geary's office, and they just make a model and they scan it in.
Really?
Yeah. They use a scanner, scan the whole model in, and they work on the computer from the scan model, yeah. And we're buying the kit that they've got to be able to do that. But I think it's, you know, I think the computer is just a, you know, it's a fantastic tool, you know. I mean, the skin work at the moment where you can see the building spin around it in three dimensions, you know, which in the old days, you know, you literally are making out of bits of cardboard and you are actually sort of, you know, moving much slower than we do now. You know, we, you know, I think project work now has got schemes number 235 or something. Where, you know, in the old days, you know, you probably have about 10 schemes. You probably wouldn't get that many. So I think, it has that ability. But and I think BIM, you know, is a development of that. You know, we've been designing in three dimensions for, you know, certainly when MATE was set up, you know, Nottingham University was all built in three dimensions and the drawings were sliced through the model. So it was a complete model rather than individual 2D drawings. So I think we've been doing it. It's just the BIM is the next level up. And we're running both Revit and Ecosim to try and find out which is the best system. And about 50% of the jobs at the moment are actually in BIM.
It does seem that Revit and BIM just seems to be kind of sliced down the middle at the moment. It's kind of, I guess it'd be interesting to see if the industry chooses a preference.
Revit and Ecosim, you mean?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, Ecosim is, you know, becoming more used for big infrastructure projects, so big rail projects, sort of pipeline projects, whereas Revit's stuck to the buildings. The problem is that all the computers we've got are Bentley systems, so to change to Revit is a bit of a move.
Yeah, definitely. It's a whole different language. It's a whole different thing to get into. So it's kind of, I can almost see us moving to kind of CAD technicians again, because
that would be a shame. I mean, that's what happened when we moved from drawing boards to computers. We had CAD technicians. You used to sit next to the guy with your drawing. He used to put in each line for you.
That sounds laborious.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I think we need to get the architects here, you know, and the architects being trained to actually work in both Revit and Ecosim, and actually, or just one of them if Revit becomes the way to go, because that's where we need to be. We do need to be in it, and it is fantastic. And I don't want a resistance from all the Bentley MicroStation guys, not to want to do it, because that would mean they become dinosaurs.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, if you're on a drawing board, you become the dinosaur.
But do you think, you were saying about you want to make a zero carbon building or a zero carbon positive building. Yeah. Again, do you think BIM allows us more opportunity to?
I don't see that side of it. No, maybe it does, but maybe I haven't understood it. But I don't see how she helping that at all. Really, I think it's just a tool for coordination that enables us to do better and better coordinated buildings. So, you know, you don't get things not fitting on site. Mm. You know, steelwork going up at the moment on London Wall Place, it's all fitting together beautifully. You know, it's all been done. It's all been thought about in three dimensions before it actually hits the site. And I think that's the benefit of it. And I think with the client's benefits, obviously at the end of the day, they get a sort of complete set of drawings of the building. They can just barcode, what the light bulb, and they can look on the drawings. They get told what the light bulb actually is. I think that's the benefit. I don't think we've actually fully understood the benefit for us. Other than, you know, it's more like an FM. Benefit at the moment.
That's what I kind of how I feel as well. Yeah. But we're kind of coming up to the 40-minute mark, so I'll slowly start to kind of wrap this up a little bit. But I did want to talk about Sharon gave me a list of other things that you've been doing around MATE, and quite an extensive list actually. So I was going through, and you had CABE, which has now become it's a new thing. I can't remember what it's called now.
Design Council.
Design Council. Yeah. And then you're also in the future. You are running the Future Spaces Foundation.
Yep.
But you also, I want to talk about both those things, but you do tutoring, or you have done tutoring up in Nottingham and stuff. And I was just wondering, having seen university, how it's taught now, when you were at university, has there been much of a change from, obviously apart from like CAD modelling and stuff, but actually the way it's taught and all the things that you did? I mean, when you were back at uni, is the similar system still in place? I mean, has it changed that much?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably the same, really. Mm. I mean, I think, there's computers everywhere, but I think, Yeah, certainly Nottingham University, which we have a good relationship with. You know, still guys carving bits of foam up to make models and things, and working on by hand on drawing boards a bit as well. No, I don't think it's changed that much. I think, in a way, the you know, the architecture education is a whole new subject, which, you know, with the, you know, the amount of money it's costing to go through architecture school at the moment. I mean, you know, people are looking at alternatives.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Because, I mean, you know, it's a lot of money. I couldn't have afforded to do it now.
£9,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. Plus all your living expenses.
Yeah, you're looking like £70,000 or something for it. It seems, you know, yeah, architecture's fantastic, but it's never going to pay off a £70,000 debt. I mean...
Well, it might do.
Might do one day. And, but how was... how was uni for you? Was it... Were you...
Yeah, no, I went to Leicester Polytechnic. I was I had a grant, so, you know, that you, basically in those days you got paid to go. Wasn't very much, but you got enough money to sort of live on. The uni was great. I mean, I had a great time at Leicester. I was there all the way through. I did my year out at Foster's on Willis Faber in Ipswich, which was fantastic. And then went back. And in my final year at university, I also worked full-time at Foster's. So I did a sort of night shift on university work and then worked during the day.
Sounds pretty intense.
Yeah, it was good. It was good, though. I mean, I loved it. We had a great time. And I think, you know, Leicester School of Architecture was, at the time, was great. It went through a bit of a dip and then it's, you know, come back again. So anybody from, it's now called De Montfort University, of course, but anybody from De Montfort, I tend to interview just to see what's going on.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, to see, make sure the school's doing well.
Wow, that's so. The other things you're involved with. So the Future Spaces Foundation. That's something you've run.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something we had when we set up Make. We had another brand called Spatial Futures, and that was a sort of the idea of actually being able to do research and have a sort of little ginger group to actually do research and you know, look at things outside the normal day job. Nothing ever happened because we were just too busy. Mm-hmm. And then 10 years in, we then managed to set up the Future Spaces Foundation, which is a similar idea to actually look at. Environments, the way people live, the way people enjoy the world, understand the world. And we did the first year, we looked at the high streets, and the second year we looked at garden cities, and this year we're looking at something else. And I think it's really good. We've got a great collection of people who've come together to sort of like a think tank to talk about things. We've produced quite a nice report 2 years running, which has gone through to government.
So for people who don't know what the Future Spaces Foundation is, how would you describe it?
I mean, it's about exploring, you know, neighbourhoods and communities and the way people respond to the world, trying to make, you know, make places better, make environments better. But, you know, not just... as we are here on a project basis, actually looking at it on a much wider basis and pulling in experts and centre of cities, you know, futurologists, all sorts of people. Yeah.
So it's a think tank as much as
anything. Yeah, it's like a think tank. And it's, you know, it's got me and John Previtt from here working on it. We had Greg helped out and Francis last year on the Garden Cities thing. So, you know, it depends on what we're doing. And I think, you know, it will evolve to become... you know, very significant over time as a think tank for actually making, you know, informing policy.
And then, so how does that kind of, so working at Make and then doing that, how do you find that feeds back into Make? Does it affect decisions we have?
I think it does, because I think, you know, we've explored the Garden Cities thing, you know, in great depth. And we had a debate here, if you remember, in the office about it. And, you know, we've all concluded, in fact, Garden Cities is a really bad idea and we should actually work on brownfield sites in city centres to sort of, you know, to increase the density in cities and not build all over the greenbelt. You know, and that, I think, means that, you know, as Make, we don't take on a project that builds all over the greenbelt. So, you know, so there was a project, Sutton Coldfield, which is to build over the greenbelt, which we turned down, you know, because that's, you know, from the research, you know, that's the wrong thing to do as far as we're concerned. So it does actually affect what we do, what we don't do.
You know, it was saying, like, what kind of keeps you motivated and stuff? It must... just another avenue of things to research and stuff. Yeah. I mean, I guess, especially not having architects and other non-architects in there, they all have totally different angles to look at and view stuff. So it must be, So the Future Spaces thing, is there like online information? There's like documents?
There's a website and there's stuff on the website which people can go and look at. I think it's going to, you know, it will become a great thing over time. And I think it goes back to my point about, you know, being curious. I mean, I, you know, the curiosity that we have for the world as architects, you know, I have that in buckets. You know, well, it doesn't matter what it is. I'm really interested in whether it's, you know, flying, you know, the way that NASA can put a, you know, a sort of small Sputnik on a rock flying 165,000 miles an hour. You know, all that stuff. I'm really interested in the whole, you know, the whole world, really, you know, how things work, how things, you know, not just about individual buildings, but, you know, the whole environment that we actually live in.
Because you've also, it's just other things as well, you've also, I've seen you're sketching on your iPad and stuff as well, don't you?
Yeah.
There's loads of, like, that's a Christmas card, isn't it?
Yeah, Christmas cards on the iPad. So that's a program called Brushes that I think is a really nice program on the iPad, and you can use it. And, you know, my paintings, when I get time to paint, are quite abstract painting. And I try and disassociate my architecture with my painting, because in architecture, obviously, you're thinking all the time and you have to sort of, and you design everything. Whereas in painting, you try not to do that. You just try and let the paint and the brushes work for themselves, which is quite difficult to do because you know, you train not to do that.
I know. I found that when I came off Broadgate, was going back onto a project where we were just every week changing, was I took me a couple of weeks to just stop drumming in detail straight away and to like kind of stand back. And it's that's, I think, because especially when Make's got so big now, I guess people would naturally assume that, you know, well, you run Make, you can't be involved in all the projects. But it seems that, you know, we have like weekly or almost daily now meetings where you come over and we kind of sketch ideas and stuff. So it's trying to get used to that kind of speed of development, you know, trying to, even with all our modern CAD equipment, we're still making loads of foam models.
Still sketching, yeah.
Still sketching, still making massive laser cut models out of card and foam, which we hilariously wheel to meetings, which we had to take a big model and there was the downdraft from a skyscraper, knocked my skyscraper clean up into the road. But so the CABE Council, which is no more, it's called the Design Council?
CABE. Yeah, it's the Design Council CABE. Yeah, so it's the old CABE. So CABE was Commission for the Architecture and Built Environment, which then lost its funding, must be about 3 years ago. And it basically merged with the Design Council. And it's basically doing design review. So it's now self-funded, which is quite interesting. So
self-funded?
So the government withdrew the funding. And it had, you know, it was about 90 people when it was at its peak, doing lots of stuff.
90 people.
Not just design review, but enabling, you know, helping people out on design and their projects around the country. And all that got scrapped. So it's doing design review, and there's a few people here now. I think John and Ian are both on what's called a B, which is a built environment expert, and they go to design reviews. And that's what CABE's really become, is a sort of design review sort of service that you can buy. So if you go around the country, you know, wherever you go, there's always a design review panel. There's always a panel of experts from the local area who are, you know, give comment on architecture, which is great, you know. And I think what happens is that CABE are flogging that service around the country. It seems to be, you know.
Do you think it's important to have that kind of, I guess, outsider perspective to kind of critique architects?
I think it's always good to be, it's always good to criticise what you know, to look critically at what you're doing, and you know, and having some outside help every now and again just to help that, you know, to say, are you sure about that? You know, or you know, have you thought about this? And it's always, I always think, because of that exploration side of me, I always think, oh, that's interesting, we haven't looked at that, or yeah, that's no, we're not going to do that, or you know, just be interested to get other opinions. And I think, you know, the Broadgate scheme that evolved over 12 months, continuous self, you know, analysis of that with, you know, with people coming in from outside to look at it as well.
That was quite intense, I remember. It was like, because especially when you're presenting to a total outsider. So it's, again, I always remember that they see it from afresh. And you don't lose perspective, but you know, you can't step back far enough to see it from what it is. So I remember those being really helpful. I mean, they were tough and stressful, but they were helpful, I think, in the end. And I've just noticed on my notes, another one you've got is you're in the Science Building Museum.
Science Museum, you know, has an advisory panel, which is on their master plan, which is basically on all their design and their projects. And I've been involved with that for the last 12 months. So
that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, so they've got, you know, some great projects. They've got Zaha doing a part of one of their, you know, galleries. They've got they've got all sorts of interesting architects involved. Wilkinson Air have done quite a lot down there. And we're just like a set, as me and Steve McGovern, a guy called Nick Kirkbride, who are the three founding members of this, and we are, you know, different skills, and we just advise the team on what they, you know, what they should and shouldn't look for. I'm quite enjoying that. It's quite good fun because, you know, the Science Museum has sort of been left behind, really. If you look at, you know, it's got, obviously got big new galleries, but some of the old galleries are the same as they were when I was a child. You know, they're literally the same as well as, you know, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
So there's a big room for change there. So I've quite enjoyed doing that. It's been really
I was going to say, especially think of the opportunity. I remember we went to a science museum in Germany. I can't remember the name of it. I'll have to fish it out. And some of the stuff they had in there was amazing. It was a Zaha building and it was a science museum over in Germany. And it was incredible because, like, instead, unlike a gallery where, I don't know, there's more requirements. The science museum, it's kind of, it's supposed to kind of engage the creative imagination, isn't it? So you can kind of, maybe make need to do a science museum.
Yeah. I mean, there's a really good one by Renzo in San Francisco, which I went to see as well. So, you know, I think the objects they have down at the science museum are amazing. They've got, you know, all sorts of stuff.
Well, I think, so we'll wrap it up. So what's kind of next to make? Like, what are the kind of, is it?
I think the, it's just do better and better buildings. I don't think there's any, you know, we're not saying we have to be, you know, earning so much money that we don't do any of that. We don't do any, you know, targets. You know, we're not trying to break into every country in the world. I think we just want better and better buildings. And I think there'd be a mood here to do some cultural work, you know, which would be great, but, you know, very difficult to get.
Yeah.
You know, and we'll move towards that. I would love to do a freestanding and more freestanding towers, maybe an airport, more public buildings, you know, but that's fine. You know, we've got, there's plenty of time yet to do all that. You know. And I, you know, still enjoy the office buildings, absolutely love office buildings, absolutely love.
Yeah.
And I'm now junior vice president of the BCO, British Council of Offices. So I'll be organising the British Council of Offices big conference in 2017. Which would be good fun.
Wow.
So that's quite good fun.
If you need cyclists for that,
I need cyclists
to come. Yeah.
Yeah. Need lots of cyclists for that. Yeah.
Well, I'll wrap it up for that. Thank you, Ken. That was really helpful. Thanks.
Thank you.
And there you go. That was episode 7 of the Create More podcast with Ken Shuttleworth. It was great just listening back to that. I just suddenly realised how much fun it actually was. It was hilarious. I mean, I do try and describe what the room was like at the beginning, but it was literally a 3 meter by 1.5 meter room. It was actually an old store cupboard. And when they found out I was doing the podcast, and I spoke to Sharon and Carly and Martha, and they were very helpful. And Ken wanted to set up like a room to do Skype calls and video conferencing and stuff and interviews. And I said, well, I jumped to the chance, and they were like, oh, Ben's very proactive, not knowing I wanted to use it 100% for the podcast. And so within literally the space of 24 hours, I'd speed ordered some soundproof material, cleaned this cupboard out, and it went from being a broom cupboard, quite literally a broom cupboard, to being my little recording studio. And I've got to be honest, the glue that we stuck up, the acoustic foam in that room, bearing in mind, I'd literally just stuck it all together. The room was completely surrounded in it. And I won't lie to you, I went really lightheaded. Ken seemed to be absolutely fine with it. But the last 5 minutes of the interview, I was thinking, because the door was obviously shut. There was no ventilation. And I swear to God, I can still smell it now. And obviously, you're supposed to leave the room open. I didn't. Left it over. Left it closed the whole night. And yeah, it was, a bit much it was. So it's been set up now properly, but that was brilliant fun. And now I have basically a recording studio. So I also recorded Alistair Parvin in there as well, which he found very amusing because a few of the tiles slowly started to peel off the wall as I was interviewing him. That was really good fun. So I hope you enjoyed that. And next fortnight's podcast is a mystery. Because everyone's on summer holiday, and I may have 1, 2, 3 or none podcasts for you in the next 2 weeks. So it's hard having to do a podcast every 2 weeks. I am trying to keep the momentum up, but people are busy over summer. People have kids and lives. So I remain hopeful. It might be, I'll tell you what, I'll build it up. It might be Johnny Tucker from Blueprint. It might be Chris from Studio Octopi, who does the Thames Bath, and it might be Victoria, who does Open School for Architecture. So, which one will it be? So I really hope you listen to the next one. Subscribe if you like it, or share it with... forgot to say, we've crashed past 1,000 downloads now. So, So you guys seem to be generally enjoying it. And I got loads of really nice response from Alistair Parvin one. Lots of nice responses about that. So, I'm going to continue down that avenue, actually. I'm rambling now. So, thank you so much for listening. Share it. Check me out on Twitter. If you want to chat to me, I'm on Twitter at Plaid Studio. So, thank you so much. And speak to you soon. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.